Now it's time for Inside the Clubhouse, a show dedicated to the Chicago baseball fan, featuring the best Chicago baseball conversation, as well as the big MLB topics, along with the biggest names, greatest guests, and listener interaction, starring Score baseball insider Bruce Levine and half of Chicago's number one sports morning show, David Haw, on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station presented by Bet Rivers Sportsbook.
And good morning, everybody, and welcome into Inside the Clubhouse every Saturday morning here on 670 The Score. David Haw has the day off. I'm Mike Esposito in for David today, alongside my friend and the baseball expert here on The Score, the very Bruce Levine. Hey, Bruce, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Mike. It's great to have you with us. David Haw has the weekend off, well-deserved rest time for David, and I'm going to have fun with you here today, Mike, as we talk to the greatest fans in the game of baseball, and that's the Chicago baseball fans, about a myriad of different subjects, some a little bit more uncomfortable than others, some a little bit more fun, as we talk about trades and free agency for both the Cubs and White Sox in the offseason. But our first topic of the day, and again, join Mike and myself at 312-644-6767, as this show is essential for you to join in for us because it is totally interactive. And Mike, the first subject of today's show is going to be about the labor situation between the Players Association and Major League Baseball. The owners had their quarterly meetings here in Chicago on Thursday. And at the time, Commissioner Rob Manfred addressed some of the issues going on. To catch everybody up very quickly, December 1st is the deadline for the collective bargaining agreement to end. It's a five-year deal that will end at 11:59 on December 1st. And what does that mean? That means that at that point in time, all the rules and regulations for Major League Baseball kind of cease to exist. And that means that communication will have to be considered something that might or might not go on. So it allows the players to strike. It allows the owners to lock out. And lock out means this, Mike. If the owners decide to lock the players out, that means that all communication between both sides completely stops. There is no free agent signings. There are no trades. There is no communication other than the labor people on each side to discuss when to go back to conversing again on getting a labor agreement done. If you think back to 1994, that was a strike, not a lockout. That strike ended in baseball losing the rest of the season from August 12, 1994 until the end of the year, losing the first and only World Series during that dispute. Since then, the last 27 years, there has been relative harmony between the owners and the players, except for 2020, when we had the height of COVID and the idea that baseball wouldn't start until later. And the dispute became a little bit of an ugly one, Mike, between owners and players as to how many games would be played, meaning how much the players would make per game. So
right.
From all of that, there's been a little distrust recreated here that has followed these negotiations going on, and we are looking at that deadline of December 1st as a possible lockout. So, Mike, I know you have some tape from Rob Manfred.
Yep.
He'll describe to you, and Mike, send it to the tape when you're ready. He'll describe to you what a lockout means to owners.
Absolutely, no. And Rob Manfred at the owners' meetings, as you said, Bruce, so what they're looking at, and certainly the players, I mean, economics, money, certainly the top of the list, but the league is as healthy as it's ever been economically. $11 billion in annual revenue. The players obviously want a higher piece of that pie. And that figures to be the main point in negotiation. But here's Rob Manfred from the other day at the owners' meetings.
Believe me, we're ready to go. We will not, did not make today, and will not make a decision as to what's next. We're focused on making an agreement prior to December 1. I think when you look at other sports, the pattern has become to control the timing of the labor dispute and try to minimize the prospect of actual disruption of the season. That's what it's about. It's avoiding doing damage to the season. I can't believe there's a single fan in the world who doesn't understand that an off-season lockout that moves the process forward is different than a labor dispute that costs games. I don't think there's anybody who understands any better than I do that from the perspective of the fans, they don't want a labor dispute, and that's why our number one priority is to make a deal.
So that's Rob Manfred from the owners' meetings the other day, Bruce, and lots in there, and I get what he's saying, and it does make sense, and you mentioned it. In 1994, not only did they lose games, they lost the World Series, and I won't prod White Sox fans along anymore, but certainly one of the favorites that year to win the whole thing was the Frank Thomas-led Chicago White Sox. So that was right. a painful one on the South side and all across baseball. But you lost the whole back half of the 94 season, that the whole postseason, and then the beginning of the 95 season. And what Manfred is basically saying there is, and he mentions December 1 and trying to get a deal done. But, I mean, is that realistic? I don't think anyone expects them to walk up here, you know, right after Thanksgiving and say, "Yep, everything's solved. We have our deal." I think they're all like, kind of expecting that lockout to happen, right?
Right. So here's what the deal is. And, again, 312-644-6767 to chime in on your thoughts about lockout strike and the impact on you, the fan, and how you are observing this, because that is the essential thing that both sides are worried about. You, the fan, you, the Chicago fan in particular here, support this sport, okay? Make no mistake about it. You control all the revenues. Every single dollar of revenue comes from you, the fans. So you should probably have a seat at that table when these negotiations go on, because nothing happens without you, and therefore, Inside the Clubhouse is your area to join in and give your idea as well. But, Mike, the basic issues are these. The Players Association at this time are concerned about service time. In particular, let's point out the Chris Bryant situation from 2015 when he was held back after hitting 11 home runs during spring training. And he was held back from making that team, held back 2 weeks for service time so that the Cubs could control his contract for a seventh year. And that is the manipulation of service time is a major focus for the Players Association. They want increase of pay from the minimum pay, which is about $575,000 a year right now, to close to $1 million for players that are one to threes. One to threes are people that are under that control, and at the behest of the owners, they pay you what they wish. It sounds like a lot of money. It is a lot of money. But keep in mind, the average career of a Major League Baseball player, Mike, is 4 years. Okay, mm-hmm. So keep that in mind. Number three, de-emphasize losing as a reward. What does that mean? That means that payrolls for teams that are quote-unquote tanking or not trying to win remain low, and teams can make more money. And as a result of that, high draft picks go to those teams who do the worst, okay? So it's kind of a contrary situation in the mind of players that you save money by not paying properly to upwards of $210 million, which is the luxury tax number, where you start paying extra tax. And for losing and being horrible, you get the highest draft picks because teams pick during the draft in reverse order of finish. So those are the main issues for the players. For the owners, they would prefer dropping the luxury tax from the $210 million that they're at right now to about $180 million. So that would be a much harder soft cap. And adding in that a minimum that owners pay, which would be $120 million. That's the first offer. So what does that mean? Right now, there's no minimum that teams can pay for total payroll. They can have the lowest that they want. So this would encourage owners to increase and not tank by having a minimum that they have to spend. Point two for owners, getting another round of playoffs. Essential, actually, for both sides, Mike, because it's all about big revenues coming in from extra TV money for extra rounds of playoffs.
Yep.
Mike, purists don't like this because of the fact that extra round of playoffs means watering down the 162-game season and its meaning. You see it in basketball. You see it in hockey. Nobody really concentrates too much on who wins the season, who has the best record. And baseball has always rewarded teams that have the best record for 162 games. In particular with home field advantage all the way through. Now that would be another consideration of whether people meaning fans, reject the meaning of the 162-game schedule or make it something that they pay less attention to. Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, I'll play devil's advocate there, and I'm as much of a purist as I think most baseball purists are. But to me, I've kind of grown on the expanded playoffs, if only for this. And this kind of goes to tanking as well. The more teams that are in it, the more playoff slots that are available, the more, we saw it this year. Atlanta was under 500 at the break, right? Before the trade deadline, they went all in for this year because they thought they could do it. And lo and behold, they won the World Series without the extra playoff spots, without some of the added postseason things. You have a lot of those teams at midseason probably saying, like the Cubs did this past year, sorry, we're out. Now, the White Sox, you knew they were in. That was a no-brainer this year. But those teams on the middle, those teams on the fence, are we going for it this year, or are we going to try to trade off some guys and get some prospects? I think that number lowers if you have more playoff spots. It's just logic, right? So to me, that's a good thing.
Yeah, take it a step further, Mike, in that NFL starts in September. People start paying more attention to the NFL, less attention to Major League Baseball, and in particular in the cities where the teams are not competitive for the playoffs. So adding that makes more cities, more city fan bases interested, yep, in the team as they move forward through September into October baseball. That is important. And so the revenues and keeping fan attention during NFL time is really very important. The third issue that owners are most interested in, and that is time of game, okay? So yep, they have experimented in the minor leagues with a 15-second pitching clock and a 15-second pitching clock at the Arizona Fall League, which ends up with a championship game today in Arizona, in the Phoenix area. So, Mike, the 20-second clock is essential, and I think it's important, really, for all people in baseball, not just the owners, but the players as well, who can use it as a negotiating tool. And that is, games have jumped again to 3 hours and 10 minutes average, mm-hmm, for a Major League Baseball game. This is almost 50 minutes more than a game used to be in the late 60s and early 70s. So with that in mind, that also creates less standing around time, more action, quicker action. I think that's an essential thing that the, yep, owners want, but it is a negotiating tool right now. So,
Joe Madden was on with Lawrence Holmes the other day, And Joe is one of our favorite guests on The Score. He and Lawrence have always done wonderful segments on Lawrence's show, noon to 2 every weekday right here on The Score. And Joe Maddon, on with Lawrence the other day, talked about speed of the game.
Where baseball is going, I'm just watching the games. When you don't get a chance to play in the playoffs, which I did, which I hate, but when you get a chance to watch some of these games, what really stands out to me is the pace. I mean, it has nothing to do with length of the game, because if it's interesting, it's interesting. But pace of the game definitely needs to be addressed, I believe. And I think I read some of the commissioner's comments about the clock. And that, to me, that's the one that's, out of everything that's been done, that's the most fascinating to me. And that's the one that I think, like when you're hitting coach, you try to go to the main core issue that hitter has that might correct 3 or 4 other things that are wrong. And if you attack that one thing, the other things, without even saying anything to him, correct. I think the same thing with this. I think pace of the game, the clock, I'd be interested to see that to be incorporated, and then let everything else roll. I just think the flow of the game being more abrupt, more quick, ball in play, here we go, lineup, here comes the pitch. I mean, from the sidelines, and I think from the bleach, from the stands, I think that would be the most attractive component of all of this. And that's it. I'm into it. I'm into the pace, rule changes, all that stuff. I'm not into it. I did definitely into getting rid of the tacky stuff. I thought that was wise. Actually, I thought that was very wise. But other things like bigger bases and all this other stuff, I'm not nearly as attracted to things like that as I am to just, let's get the ball and pitch it, get in play, get the batter in the box, let's play.
There's Joe Maddon on with Lawrence Holmes, Bruce, and Joe preaching to the choir, I think, when you talk about a lot of baseball fans about let's get the ball, let's pitch it, let's put it in play, let's try to cut out a lot of the more stagnant parts of the game, which, and I know, I mean, you watched the postseason games. A lot of those games, I mean, you know, 4 hours easy by the time you got through with it. And for a 7 o'clock game starting in Chicago, I remember watching with my wife the Braves celebration after they won the World Series, and it was pushing midnight here in Chicago. It's like, holy cow. It's like, you know, you're certainly losing the kids going to sleep crowd, right? There you're losing a lot of people who don't want to stay up till, you know, 12:30, 1 in the morning watching playoff baseball.
Well, and that's a great point, Mike. The idea that you have your golden time of the year where your playoffs are going on, you have your World Series, the most exciting time of the year for a baseball fan, and kids aren't watching it. Okay, they can't watch it. They have to go to school the next day. You know, all the games are usually, you know, a couple of them are on the weekends, but the majority, you know, are midweek. So from that perspective, it's essential that time of the game is addressed, and the pitch clock seems to be a really good way to address it. So why a lockout? Okay, why does the commissioner insist a lockout is a good thing? Two things. First of all, from the perspective of players are faced during a lockout with less pay, okay? If the lockout persists into a regular season, that means that they're going to get paid less for that year. Major League Baseball players get paid from the first game of the year to the last game of the year. They do not get paid any other time of a 65-day year. So that's essential to keep in mind. They're locked out. They have no benefits. They have no access to the stadiums where the games are played or spring training. For the owners, the incentive of a lockout, and a quick one, is that they are not pushing out their chest saying, we are locking you out. What they're saying is, this needs to get you to the table and for us to get these things figured out. It hurts us, too, because during a lockout, Mike, imagine the Cubs, White Sox, and the other 28 teams trying to sell tickets. And one of the ticket representatives calling you, a season ticket holder, and saying, hey, we'd like to have your money in. We'd like to have you back. Mm-hmm. And you saying, what does your team look like? Okay, who's on your team? When are there going to be games? I'm not interested right now. So there is a great incentive for the teams to be able to also be able to sell ancillary things, including the important season tickets and tickets during the off season. Nobody's buying tickets for a game they don't think exists at the present time.
No doubt about it, Bruce. 312-644-6767 is our number. The Score listener line powered by BetQL. Bet smarter and beat the books. Download the BetQL app today or visit BetQL.com. As Bruce said, we always want your input via text or via call, and we do have a caller on the line. Jack is in Hillside talking about pace of play. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning. How are you doing, fellas?
Good, Jack.
Good. What's up, Jack?
Okay. So, listening to your discussion thus far, of course, I'm more interested in some of the player movement and so forth. But hearing Joe Maddon talk about pace of the game, I completely agree with him, as one generally does. And I think Maddon certainly knows as much about the game as anyone. I'm wondering a thing that occurred to me on that topic as I watch the replays as regards to sliding plays, either at second and third base especially. I find those to be just unnecessary and awful because, you know, the way one slides, there's that little gap in there. We're going to always be treating. I wonder what you might think of this, Bruce, unlikely. The sliding into second base, once you touch the base, you're safe. You can go past the base. It doesn't matter. It essentially like first base or home plate. And it would eliminate to me so many of these replays. What's your thought?
Jack, thank you for your call. You know, that's really interesting, Mike, because, you know, for about 145 years before replay became so exact and was used to the extent it's used, umpires would call contact to the bag pretty much the guy safe. And that microsecond where the foot pops off and back on has now changed a safe call to an out call. And I kind of like that idea because of the fact that, in essence, the player actually does beat the play. He has reached that base. When you run to first base and you're trying to be safe, you don't have to retain the contact to that base, right? You just have to run through that base to be safe at first. This is taking that concept to second and third as well. It's also not essential at home plate to keep contact on the plate. So therefore, it's not incongruent to some of the established ways that you are ruled safe. I kind of like it because it really does reward the guy for getting there quicker than the ball and the glove and the mitt.
Spirit of the rule rather than the exact, as you said, the microsecond that their foot might not be on the base and the tag is still on there. Just like, you know, with double plays where, you know, on the throw to second, if the second baseman is kind of straddling the bag, and, you know, he might have touched it a half a second too early, but it's in the process of completing that double play. That is almost automatically called an out. Well, now you're going to review every frame of film to see and make sure if he had the ball and the base at the same time. I mean, we saw for decades and decades where those were very crisp plays, but I digress. We will get back to this momentarily throughout the show. We have a great show planned for you. Coming up next, Eduardo Perez from ESPN. You also know him from MLB Network Radio. He will join us to talk Hall of Fame and a Chicago favorite that maybe, just maybe, might be getting in this year on the Golden Days committee vote. We'll also have the Angels general manager, Perry Minasian, joining us at the top of the 10 o'clock hour. Plus, lots of your calls, lots of your texts as well. Our new Chicago-bound segment about free agency. All of that and more. This is Inside the Clubhouse. Bruce Levine, Mike Esposito in for David Haw today. This is 670 The Score.
Mini represented us in a beautiful way. He was all that you can imagine on and off the field, not just because the way that he played, but just the way that he handled himself off the field, how he represented us in the baseball world, but also, you know, in the society. You know, Mini was over Jackie Robinson.
That was Jose Contreras through White Sox interpreter Billy Russo talking about Minnie Minoso and his impact on the game and certainly on the Cuban players, and the White Sox still to this day have that Cuban pipeline open. Lots of Cuban-born players on the Chicago White Sox, and Minnie Minoso was the man who started all that. Let's head on out now, Bruce, to the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline. Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book.
One of the most unique and interesting broadcasters in the game of baseball, our guest right now, as we are fortunate to have my friend Eduardo Perez, who does such a great job on MLB Radio and ESPN Television broadcasting games, joining us on our hotline. Good morning, Eduardo. How are you today?
Good morning, Bruce. Good morning, Mike. Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here with you guys.
Well, it's great to have you on. And, you know, listening to you on MLB Radio during the weeks and watching you on broadcasts, you bring a unique perspective to the game of baseball because you cover so much history of the game, from your father, Tony, who was a Hall of Famer, all the way through your career and now into broadcasting. And you give both the Latino side and the side that we are accustomed to in the United States its proper perspective. And you're the perfect guest to have on today to talk baseball with, because of the fact that on December 5th, the committee that hears is called the Golden Days Committee will hear the case for 10 different players who played between 1950 and 1969 to be elected by the 16-man committee, or not elected at that particular point. And many of these players, like Minnie or Orestes Minnie Minoso, or Minoso, the proper way to pronounce it, have been looked at before and have been skipped over. Eduardo, give us a good idea as to why this time around maybe that committee will be looking at some different, looking at the career of Orestes Minnie Minoso.
Well, that's a very complex question, but I really appreciate the question there, Mike. And one of the things that I look at is you know, we have to look at these statistics, because the first thing everybody leans to is the statistics of the players. I look at, yes, you have to definitely take that into consideration. You go into the Hall of Fame, when that plaque goes up, you look at what that player not only meant statistically, but what that player meant to that generation. And I think that those are two different things. I think it would be unfair to try to compare the game of baseball today to what it was back then. Look, Minnie was, and you heard it right there, and you hear it so many times from so many players, that they try to say he's the Jackie Robinson of baseball for the Latino players. I think he was much more than that, not only because he was an Afro-Latino, but because he was a player that decided that I'm going to play and I'm going to fail my way. And my way means I'm going to show speed. I'm going to show character. I am going to also be able to go out to the ballpark and do it with that Latin flair, something that really a lot of people here in the United States had not seen. And the first couple years after Minnie having been in the Negro Leagues, once he goes to the Cleveland Indians for two seasons, doesn't really play much. They had African Americans on that team, and really good ones, especially in the outfield. So he had to sit and watch until the Chicago White Sox decided that, okay, we're going to trade for him and we're going to let him play. And as soon as they allowed him to play, it was, you saw triples, you saw stolen bases, you saw hit by pitches, you saw the fearlessness there. And he opened the gateway for those Latinos to come into the major leagues and continue to play the game the right way. But it was so difficult in that era to do it without, and you heard Jose Contreras' words, without an interpreter. Knowing that every other Latino kid was going to be watching and saying, if you do well, I'll be able to then come in and do well as well. And that was the impact that Manny had also on my on our family, because he was my dad's favorite player growing up. And listening to the stories of my father about Manny, once he was enlisting from Cuba, to see how he did at the major league level, really just opened my eyes to who Manny Muñoz was.
Eduardo Perez is our guest here on Inside the Clubhouse. Eduardo, Mike Esposito here. It's great to talk to you and great to have you on the show. Appreciate your perspective, certainly. And what strikes me about exactly what you're talking about, not only was Manny a very toolsy player. I mean, he could hit for power. The steals were always there. Great range in the outfield. Played every day, and really, you know, was a stalwart for the White Sox for many years there. But what Jose Contreras had to say, and this is decades after the fact, about how he was viewed by that younger generation of Cuban players coming over. I mean, that all has to resonate with this committee, doesn't it?
It has to, and I hope it really does. And it depends, because every year the committee is different. And that's the one thing that you sometimes have to hope that the committee is understands who those, what those players meant to each generation. Look, Dick Allen is on this voting, and everybody in Philadelphia is going to be also, you know, saying, why not Dick Allen? Look at the numbers. You look at Tony Oliva's numbers as well, and you know a lot of people are hoping the same thing there. If you're especially with the impact that Buck O'Neill had off the field, that's another name that a lot of people in our generation, because of what he meant not only to baseball on the field, but what he meant to the African American player, the African American coach. Because he was the first African American coach to be able to put on a uniform with the Chicago Cubs. There are so many stories that can be said. But for those Latinos that are in the big leagues right now wearing that big league uniform, just like the African Americans are wearing that big uniform and they understand what number 42 means to African American, Manny Muñoz, wearing number 9 in Chicago, that was the number that he represented there. He wore, yes, I understand he wore number 6 with Cleveland when he first broke, but it was number 9 that people know him by, especially in Chicago because of the mark that he made. I understand that really well. And that's why when I even went to play in Japan, I wanted to wear number 9 there. And I asked for it because it was Manny Muñoz's number, and I understood the relevance of it, and I understood the importance of being able to do that. And he was the one that opened the gateways for many of the Latinos in the game of baseball at the major league level. And being a man of color, again, identifying with him as so many players do, and the impact that he had post-career as a player, knowing that he was what he meant. And I think Contreras said it perfectly. Look, he spoke to him in English because you have to try and learn to adapt. Yes, they have to understand your culture, but you also have to adapt in order to be successful. And that's why he was so highly respected in the baseball community, not only just in Chicago, but all around baseball.
That's the voice of Eduardo Perez. You hear him on MLB radio during weekdays in the morning. You also watch him on ESPN television doing broadcasts. He does a terrific job. He has a great voice in our game of baseball. Eduardo, the social impact of Manny Muñoz, I felt personally growing up in the 50s and 60s, watching him as the first significant player of color that played on the Chicago White Sox, him and on the north side, Ernie Banks at the same time. And the thing that stood out to me over the years as I grew up and then looked back at what they had to go through was the fact that these were two guys that stood tall both on and off the field. They had to be the perfect person on both because of the impact it had on their races and those races continuing to be able to flourish in Major League Baseball and in all of sports in the United States. Your thoughts about the social impact and what Minnie and Ernie and some of those people from those times had to go through.
Oh, yeah. You know what? The interesting thing is I hear the stories all the time. And but personally, I can tell you, when you look back, you fast forward a couple decades when my father was able to get to the big leagues in 1964. And before that, it was how important it was for him. And I use the word adapt. Is what was going on in the United States was not going on in Cuba, in his island in Cuba. And it was all the discrimination and just the rules that you had to abide by, the segregation that was going on, and all those little things that they had to adapt, especially many coming over to a new country. I remember my father telling me, he goes, it was the first time that I could not go in through a front door into a Cuban restaurant. I had to order from on the side of a door on the outside and eat outside. And this was decades before, this was decades after Minnie was even, you know, had already played, had already opened the gates for Atanasio Perez Rigal, which is my dad's real name, then known as Tony, to be able to play. And those stories, those are the adaptations that they had to do socially outside the lines. This is not something that they grew up seeing. It is something that as adults they had to learn how to be able to, that if you wanted to pursue this dream of playing at the major league level, these are the things that you had to adapt to, unfortunately, at that time in the United States. That's why you always saw so many African-American players then, as soon as the season went over, go play if it was in Mexico, in the Dominican Republic, in Puerto Rico, in Cuba before it shut down. All those players would make their names overseas, play winter ball, and then come back and play in the United States. And it was because it was a different ball game. The legacy that Minnie Mignoso left was not only an impact on the field between the lines, but I think the most important thing is what he left to every player after he played and during the days that he was playing, is the impact that he left for them, that he opened the door for them to adapt outside the lines. And to me, that's the most important part. Everybody thinks, well, just look at the numbers between the lines. Look at the home runs. They only hit 100 and we talked about this the other day.
Yeah, 198.
When you hit 195, and 135 of those home runs were with a Chicago White Sox uniform. But you look at the at Comiskey Park and how big that ballpark was at that time. I mean, if we would have used the expected slugging that we use now in this data that helps a lot of players get votes, if it's for Rookie of the Year or MVP or whatever it may be, I think those numbers would definitely help Minnie and adapt to it. One more thing I must add. Rod Carew always told me, he was my first hitting coach, and I listened to many stories about Rod. He would say, look, I could have hit a lot more home runs in my career, but that was not my job. My job was to get on base for Kilbrew, for Oliva, for the big boys. That was what I was supposed to do. And if they told me to hit home runs, I would have done the same thing. Minnie was that type of player as well. His job was to get on base, create havoc, play great defense, and do whatever it took for his team to be able to win. It's a different game in today's world. I think Minnie Mignoso would have definitely easily had over 300 home runs in his career if he would have had the opportunity earlier, and most importantly, depending on what the role was. That's why I said every statistic is balanced differently depending on the player, the ballpark, and what their role on that team was supposed to be.
Well, and Eduardo, we could do this for another hour and a half, I'm sure, because we haven't even touched any of the other guys on that Golden Days era ballot, which a lot of them, you mentioned Dick Allen, but a lot of them to me are deserving. But really appreciate your insights on Mini, and I know a lot of Chicagoans and a lot of White Sox fans in particular will be watching closely to see what happens here in the Golden Days era ballot. But we really appreciate you joining us here on Inside the Clubhouse.
Oh, thanks, Mike. And Bruce, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. We'll have to talk some more baseball with you really soon, because your insight into the game is by far a unique and fun perspective. Have a great day, Eduardo. Thanks again for joining us.
Oh, thank you. All right, take care, guys.
Take care. That's Eduardo Perez. You know him from ESPN TV. You know him from MLB Radio, and if you're old guys of a certain age, you remember his dad, Tony Perez, from the Big Red Machine. Bruce, I wanted to ask
the
Red Machine
easy.
Questions.
Take it
I know.
Easy.
I put myself in that category, too. So, but really fascinating to hear him talk about the historical perspective, certainly from the Latino player perspective on Mini Minoso, and how that kind of broke down barriers, and Eduardo connected it directly to his dad breaking in. And I know a lot. I mean, you think about Jose Contreras played decades after Mini Minoso, and to hear him talk about that, it's really fascinating.
Well, Billy Pierce fans and Dick Allen fans, they are both being looked at by the Golden Days Era Committee voting on December 5th as well. We wish them all luck, and we'll continue on with Inside the Clubhouse, 312-644-6767. Top of the hour, Perry Minasian, the general manager of the LA Angels of Anaheim, will be joining us.
That's Bruce Levine and Mike Esposito in for David Haw this week. We'll also talk about the awards, which were given out this week. And again, Perry Minasian, Angels GM, at the top of the hour. Inside the Clubhouse, right here on 670 The Score. Back on Inside the Clubhouse here on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. Bruce Levine, Mike Esposito in for David Haw this week. Great to have you along. 2 hours of baseball talk every Saturday morning. Great segment right there with Eduardo Perez, Bruce, and lots of good stuff coming up. We're going to talk about the awards. Lots of awards given out in MLB this week. MVP and Cy Youngs in both leagues. And no surprise, unanimous winner in the AL.
Yeah, Shohei Ohtani, certainly the first since Babe Ruth to be an impactful pitcher and hitter at the same time. You know, you're going over 100 years. It was a no-brainer, as you said, Mike. It was a complete victory for him, getting all first-place votes. And we will have the pleasure of talking to the general manager of the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, my friend Perry Minasian, coming up next in our next segment. So stay tuned as Mike and I continue to take you all the way through the next hour talking baseball, Cubs and Sox. We're going to be talking Chicago bound, what players in Major League Baseball via either trade or free agency will be coming to the Cubs or White Sox. That up next. But next, Perry Minasian on the newest AL MVP, Shohei Ohtani.
Yeah, and the Angels, too, Bruce, in the news this week, they ink a National League ace to a one-year deal coming off of injury. We'll talk to Perry Minasian next right here on Inside the Clubhouse on The Score.